good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 550 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show, Behind the Lies About Libya. Can't really claim I'm sure this is the truth on Libya, because I wouldn't be qualified to discern that. But these are certainly alternate opinions, which to me seem to have more credibility about them than that old one about the humanitarian intervention. To begin the show, I'm reading an article. This is by webofdebt.com's Ellen Brown from the 14th of April this year, entitled Libya, All About Oil or All About Banking. Several writers have noted the odd fact that the Libyan rebels took time out from their rebellion in March to create their own central bank, and this before they even had a government. Robert Wenzel wrote in the Economic Policy Journal, quote, I have never before heard of a central bank being created in just a matter of weeks out of a popular uprising. This suggests that we may have a bit more than a ragtag bunch of rebels running around, and that there are some pretty sophisticated influences, unquote. Alex Newman wrote in the New American, quote, in a statement released last week, the rebels reported on the results of a meeting held on March 19th. Among other things, supposed ragtag revolutionaries announced the designation of a central bank of Benghazi as a monetary authority competent in monetary policies in Libya and appointment of a governor to the Central Bank of Libya with a temporary headquarters in Benghazi. Unquote. Newman quoted CNBC editor John Carney, who asked, is this the first time a revolutionary group has created a central bank while it is still in the midst of fighting the entrenched political power? It certainly seems to indicate how extraordinarily powerful central bankers have become in our era. Another anomaly involves the official justification for taking up arms against Libya. Supposedly, it's about human rights violations, but the evidence is contradictory. According to an article on the Fox News website, on February 28th, quote, as the United Nations works feverishly to condemn Libyan leader Muammar al-Qaddafi for cracking down on protesters, the body's Human Rights Council is poised to adopt a report chock full of praise for Libya's human rights record. The review commends Libya for improving educational opportunities, for making human rights a priority, and for bettering its constitutional framework. Several countries, including Iran, Venezuela, North Korea and Saudi Arabia, also Canada, give Libya positive marks for legal protections afforded to its citizens, who are now revolting against the regime and facing bloody reprisal. Unquote. Whatever might be said of Qaddafi, the Libyan people seem to be thriving. A delegation of medical professionals from Russia, Ukraine and Belarus wrote in an appeal to Russian President Medvedev and Prime Minister Putin that after becoming acquainted with Libyan life, it was their view that in few nations did people live in such comfort. Quote, Libyans are entitled to free treatment, and their hospitals provide the best in the world of medical equipment. Education in Libya is free. Capable young people have the opportunity to study abroad at government expense. When marrying, young couples receive 60,000 Libyan dinars, about $50,000 US, of financial assistance, non-interest state loans, as the practice shows, undated. Due to government subsidies, the price of cars is much lower than in Europe, and they're affordable for every family. Gasoline and bread cost a penny, no taxes for those who are engaged in agriculture. The Libyan people are quiet and peaceful, are not inclined to drink, and are very religious. Unquote. They maintained that the international community had been misinformed about the struggle against the regime. Tell us, they said, who would not like to live in such a regime? even if that is just propaganda, there's no denying at least one very popular achievement of the Libyan government. It brought water to the desert by building the largest and most expensive irrigation project in history, the $33 billion GMMR, Great Man-Made River Project. Even more than oil, water is crucial to life in Libya. The GMMR provides 70% of the population with water for drinking and irrigation, pumping it from Libya's vast underground Nubian sandstone aquifer system in the south to populated coastal areas 4,000 kilometers to the north. The Libyan government has done at least some things right. Another explanation for the assault on Libya is that it is all about oil. But that theory too is problematic. As noted in the National Journal, the country produces only about 2% of the world's oil. Saudi Arabia alone has enough spare capacity to make up for any lost production if Libyan oil were to disappear from the market. And if it's about oil, why the rush to set up a new central bank? Another provocative bit of data circulating on the net is a 2007 Democracy Now! Interview of U.S. General Wesley Clark. In it, he says that about 10 days after September 11, 2001, he was told by a general that a decision had been made to go to war with Iraq. Clark was surprised and asked why. "I don't know," was the response. "I guess they don't know what else to do." Later, the same general said that they planned to take out 7 countries in 5 years: Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. What do these 7 countries have in common? In the context of banking, one thing that sticks out is that none of them is listed among the 56 member banks of the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS. That evidently puts them outside the long regulatory arm of the central banker's central bank in Switzerland. The most renegade of the lot could be Libya and Iraq, the two that have actually been attacked. Kenneth Shortgen Jr., writing on Examiner.com, noted that 6 months before the US moved into Iraq to take down Saddam Hussein, the oil nation had made the move to accept euros instead of petrodollars for oil, and this became a threat to the global dominance of the dollar as the reserve currency, and its dominion as the petrodollar. According to a Russian article titled "Bombing of Libya, Punishment for Gaddafi for His Attempt to Refuse US Dollar," Gaddafi made a similarly bold move. He initiated a movement to refuse the dollar and the euro, and calls on Arab and African nations to use a new currency instead, the gold dinar. Gaddafi suggested establishing a united African continent with its 200 million people using a single currency. During the past year, the idea was approved by many Arab countries and most African countries. The only opponents were the Republic of South Africa and the head of the League of Arab States. The initiative was viewed negatively by the USA and the European Union, with French President Nicolas Sarkozy calling Libya a threat to the financial security of mankind. But Gaddafi was not swayed and continued his push for the creation of a united Africa. And that brings us back to the puzzle of the Libyan Central Bank. In an article posted on the Market Oracle, Eric Encina observed, quote, "One seldom mentioned fact by Western politicians and media pundits, the Central Bank of Libya is 100% state-owned. Currently, the Libyan government creates its own money, the Libyan dinar, through the facilities of its own central bank. Few can argue that Libya is a sovereign nation with its own great resources, able to sustain its own economic destiny. One major problem for globalist banking cartels is that in order to do business with Libya, they must go through the Libyan Central Bank and its national currency, a place where they have absolutely zero dominion or power-broking ability. Hence, taking down the Central Bank of Libya may not appear in the speeches of Obama, Cameron, and Sarkozy, but this is certainly at the top of the globalist agenda for absorbing Libya into its hive of compliant nations." Unquote. Libya not only has oil. According to the IMF, its central bank has nearly 144 tons of gold in its vaults. With that sort of asset base, who needs the BIS, the IMF, and their rules? all of which prompts a closer look at the BIS rules and their effect on local economies. An article on the BIS website states that central banks in the central bank governance network are supposed to have as their single or primary objective to preserve price stability. They are to be kept independent from government to make sure that political considerations don't interfere with this mandate. Price stability means maintaining a stable money supply, even if that means burdening the people with heavy foreign debts. Central banks are discouraged from increasing the money supply by printing money and using it for the benefit of the state, either directly or as loans. In a 2002 article in Asia Times titled "The BIS versus National Banks," Henry Liu maintained, quote, "BIS regulations serve only the single purpose of strengthening the international private banking system, even at the peril of national economies. The BIS does to national banking systems what the IMF has done to national monetary regimes. National economies under financial globalization no longer serve national interests." FDI, foreign direct investment, denominated in foreign currencies, mostly dollars, has condemned many national economies into unbalanced development toward export merely to make dollar-denominated interest payments to FDI, with little net benefit to the domestic economies, unquote. He added, "Applying the state theory of money, any government can fund with its own currency all its domestic developmental needs to maintain full employment without inflation. The state theory of money refers to money created by governments rather than private banks. The presumption of the rule against borrowing from the government's own central bank is that this will be inflationary, while borrowing existing money from foreign banks or the IMF will not. But all banks actually create the money they lend on their books, whether publicly owned or privately owned. Most new money today comes from bank loans. Borrowing it from the government's own central bank has the advantage that the loan is effectively interest-free. Eliminating interest has been shown to reduce the cost of public projects by an average of 50%. And that appears to be how the Libyan system works. According to Wikipedia, the functions of the Central Bank of Libya include issuing and regulating banknotes and coins in Libya, and managing and issuing all state loans. Libya's wholly state-owned bank can and does issue the national currency and lend it for state purposes. That would explain where Libya gets the money to provide free education and medical care, and to issue each young couple $50,000 in interest-free state loans. Would also explain where the country found the $33 billion to build the Great Man-Made River Project. Libyans are worried that NATO-led airstrikes are coming perilously close to this pipeline, threatening another humanitarian disaster. So, is this new war all about oil or all about banking? Maybe both, and water as well. With energy, water, and ample credit to develop the infrastructure to access them, a nation can be free of the grip of foreign creditors. And that may be the real threat of Libya. It could show the world what is possible. Most countries don't have oil, but new technologies are being developed that could make non-oil producing nations energy independent, particularly if infrastructure costs are halved by borrowing from the nation's own publicly owned bank. Energy independence would free governments from the web of the international bankers, and of the need to shift production from domestic to foreign markets to service the loans. If the Gaddafi government goes down, it will be interesting to watch whether the new central bank joins the BIS, whether the nationalized oil industry gets sold off to investors, and whether education and health care continue to be free. An interesting set of perspectives there from Ellen Brown, a woman who certainly knows a thing or two about banking. The idea that those in positions of power would try to extend that to embrace all nations of the world seems to me a fairly convincing one. The BIS, I've just looked at their webpage and discovered I didn't know the name of the general manager or any of their recent general managers, and almost everybody on their board of directors is unknown to me, and I keep an eye out for related stuff. So it would seem they have a fairly effective media blackout. I don't think I've ever heard a commercial media reporting the name of the BIS. So if you're aware of anybody who can speak competently and authoritatively on what really goes on there, I would love to hear it. You can email me unwelcome@unwelcomeguest.net. The remainder of the show is devoted to a recording sent in by a listener. Thank you, Ben. And one of the things I found impressive about the speaker, Vijay Prashad, was the fact that he seemed quite ready to admit that he didn't have the full story, and he lays out a few pieces for us to assemble. And to help us better complement the picture, which we're given by all this up-to-date, fast-paced, and contextless coverage, which is so typical of commercial media. The recording is from 7th of April this year, and if you'd like the original, you can download it from unwelcomeguests.net/550. I've edited this slightly to fit and to try and handle things like ambient noise.
Well, just a few words of introduction. You know, I think we've all watched with some astonishment these democracy movements that have spread like wildfire, starting in Tunisia and then to Cairo, and now Jordan, Yemen, Syria, Bahrain. And like many in the room, I think we were all a bit shocked when, especially after such a tepid response from President Obama to Cairo and waiting so long, that they chose this military action of the no-fly zone along with NATO forces. And that's what's been going on for the last few weeks. And yet, you know, progressives are in a quandary about this, because we have people like Susan Rice, who's a delegate to the United Nations. We have Samantha Powers, who is very strong on both Darfur and the Rwandan genocide, now a member of the National Security Council, apparently pressing Obama for these military actions. And the liberal press is singing the praises. You all probably saw last Sunday Nicholas Kristof's op-ed piece in the Sunday Times, and he says, quote, "If the Libya operation is successful, it may help put teeth into an emerging doctrine of the, quote, responsibility to protect, quote, a landmark notion in international law that countries must intervene to prevent mass atrocities, and that might help avert the next Rwanda or the next Darfur." So these are the terms that it's being couched in. So I'm really delighted to have Vijay Prashad speak with us tonight, because Vijay, as many of you know, is a very strong and outspoken critic of some of these policies, but he really speaks from knowledge. Vijay is a professor and director of the International Studies Program and the George and Martha Kellner Chair of South Asian History at Trinity College. I tried looking up your CV today. I ran out of megabytes on my computer. Literally 18 books that he's been involved in, monographs and edited volumes. Some are quite well known. The Poor Nations, A People History of the Global South is forthcoming. Come Kalinga, The Impenitence of the Indian Right. I like that. The Darker Nations, he's very well known for A People's History of the Third World. Dispatches from Latin America, Experiments Against Neoliberalism, Keeping Up with the Dow Joneses, Debt, Prison, and Workforce. And it's probably his most well-known book, Everybody Was Kung Fu Fighting, Afro-Asian Connections and the Myth of Cultural Purity, Beacon Press wrote in 2001. He's the author of 60, I would say, peer-reviewed articles and uncountable number of popular articles for the press, for the blog, for the web. Many of you may have heard him on Democracy Now. Was it 2 weeks ago? Discussing just this issue of the U.S. Intervention in Libya. So I'm very pleased to present Vijay.
My peers are very generous. They're called peer-reviewed journals, but we all know that they are friendly peers. Let me say, several years ago, when the events were overtaking Latin America, Tariq Ali, at a discussion, asked the question, where is the Chavez of the Middle East? And maybe that was a bad question, because maybe there is no personified Chavez. Maybe one looked for something else. Maybe one looked for popular uprisings and not the Chavez of the Middle East, but maybe, you know, the people of the Middle East now fed up with the stranglehold of a combination of pharaonic nationalism, imperialism, maybe Zionism, that these social phenomena, you know, had taken them to the brink and they rose up. So they form, in a sense, if you can picture the people in Tahrir Square as a sort of Chavez of Cairo, the people speaking. So, of course, it came as a great surprise. Who expected these events to take place? And who has talked at all about the fact that in Russia there was a drought last year? And that the drought last year, like that butterfly which decides to flutter its wings far away, had a huge catastrophic impact on food prices. And, you know, before Mubarak could sense that, you know, like Marie Antoinette and let them eat cake, before he could sense that the problem of food prices had convulsed households across Egypt and hastily tried to raise the subsidy rate. But before he could have allow that to have any impact, of course, people had taken the streets. Don't underestimate the amazing impact of things like droughts in one country having an impact. There have been riots and protests against the food problem globally. It just so happens not to strike the United States very hard, because we tend not to buy primary goods, and so the price differential, we are unable to import inflation as quickly as countries where people are reliant on primary goods. After all, if we eat processed rice, the value added is already so high that the increase in the price of rice at the field hardly impacts the incredibly inflated price we already pay for, you know, that 6-minute rice or whatever it is that we buy in boxes. The value added has already killed the inflation. So it's not the case that we would get impacted as strongly. But around the world, there have been protests against the food price rise. So keep that in mind, because that certainly has to be a part of this equation. I'm not going to spend time talking about the whole spring. I want to concentrate on the U.S. government's complexity and its problems. And I would like to spend time on Libya, because that's what I know best of all. So, well, yes, Tunisia takes place, Ben Ali disappears, he goes, he takes over. Probably I fantasize that he is living now in Idi Amin's old house, because somewhere in Saudi Arabia there is an entire street of houses which are kept open for all the fleeing dictators from Africa and the Middle East. Mubarak went to the seaside, but he could just as well have become the roommate of Ben Ali in some palatial mansion. And, you know, in maybe in Tripoli, they are looking at real estate somewhere in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, as you know, is a refuge of scoundrels, including, of course, of the royal family, who met with Robert Gates recently and have started to dictate the terms of geopolitics in the region, which is extraordinary. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. So Ben Ali flees, and then you get Egypt. There is a contagion, certainly. It's over-exaggerated that this thing is about Facebook and Twitter. You already know that, you know. The telephone doesn't make the revolution, the telegraph doesn't make the revolution, but they certainly help in the Russian Revolution. It was helpful to have the telegraph after you could send messages saying what's happened here, what's happened there. Communication is certainly essential. But, you know, come on, from Cupertino, California, they are not engineering the world revolution. We know that, but let's not still set aside Facebook and Twitter. These things are important. So in Egypt, the contagion spreads. Now, of course, there are a concatenation of events that lead to the occupation of Tahrir Square. There's, of course, as I said, the bread prices. And of course, and don't forget the other important thing, they have public space. They have meaningful public space, something that in many advanced industrial countries we don't have. Imagine if we decide to go and sit in, you know, where would we sit in Washington, D.C.? Where would we be allowed to even gather for 5 minutes? The places of importance have been closed off to us. We cannot enter them. You have to get a permit. If you violate the permit, you're going to get... You know, we don't have public space like that. So you have to recognize the centrality of public space and the symbolic meaning of something named Tahrir Square. People occupy it, fine. What is the U.S. government's response? It was not anemic. It was actually kind of diabolical. They sent a man who I followed since the 1990s, partly because I have files like the counter CIA my office is filled with filing cabinets of information on different people that come past my eye. They sent Frank Wisner Jr. Now, Frank Jr. has, of course, an interesting family history. His father was an important CIA man. His father was the guy who created Wisner's Wurlitzers, sending paid press agents all over the world to promote anti-communist messages. That was Wisner Sr. helped overthrow the government of Guatemala, Arbenz. Frank Wisner Jr. was involved in the overthrow of Mossadegh. He was like everywhere. He was the CIA's main architect, and then he committed suicide. He used his son's gun, Frank Wisner Jr.'s gun. Frank Wisner Jr. had just graduated from Princeton, and then he escalated quickly up the chain in the State Department. And he found himself in the late 1980s and 1990s as ambassador in three important countries. First, he was ambassador in Egypt between 1986 and 1991. Crucially, he was ambassador in Egypt during the time when Gulf War I was to happen. That is to say that Saddam Hussein on August 2nd, 1990 invaded Kuwait, and the United States went in to Saudi Arabia to throw Saddam out of Kuwait. The United States needed Egyptian support, and Wisner Jr. was able to get Mubarak to support the ouster of Saddam from Kuwait. They became very close friends. Then Wisner will go to the Philippines, where it turns out that as part of the so-called decommissioning of American military assets, the Subic Bay base is to be decommissioned. It was decommissioned for a few years, then recommissioned because we needed the bases back. When it was decommissioned, a power plant was languishing on the property, and miraculously, a company that some of you may remember, some may not remember, you were not born when this company existed. It was an incredible company. Its name was Enron. And Enron, this incredible company, decided to come in and take over the power plant. Then Frank Wisner Jr. goes to India. He's the ambassador in India. And while he's in India, Enron is interested in building an enormous liquefied natural gas plant. And nobody's interested. 13 days, a right-wing government stays in office. The only bill they sign is to authorize Enron to build the liquefied natural gas power plant. Frank Wisner Jr. resigns from the State Department and joins the board of Enron. Yes. And then he comes to the United States, where in the foreign policy apparatus, this weird zone between Houston, Texas, and Washington, D.C., with assorted stops in Virginia along the way, they write reports about the rest of the world. Now, why Houston? Because that's where you have the Bush Institute, the Baker Institute, and all these places where these very important so-called bipartisan reports are written about the world. Frank Jr. wrote a series of reports saying how Mubarak is the great reformer. And after the last election, which Mubarak walked away with 90%+ of the vote, Frank Wisner Jr.'s assessment was, this is a great day for Egypt. Obama sends him to talk to Mubarak. And Obama sends him to talk to Mubarak while there is a demonstration across Egypt, and the military is also teetering on the side of the rebellion. One member of the military is sent off to Washington, D.C. He is General Tantawi. He becomes a familiar name later. So the general is sent to Washington to talk to the Pentagon. Frank Wisner Jr. arrives in Egypt. Then he makes a very poor judgment at a video conference in Munich. He will say that Mubarak should be allowed to have some time because he needs to cement his, the worst possible word, legacy. Okay. Everything hits the fan, and America is looking bad. Hastily, Mubarak is told, listen, chum, it's checkers for you, and Tantawi is going to be able to take over. Now, yes?
Could I ask a favor?
Go slower.
Yeah.
But I have so many things to tell you. Just don't let it fit. Just believe me. Okay, I'll go slower. So, then, in Egypt, I don't want anybody to think that I'm trying to say that the Egyptian revolution was not important and was not central. Because one of the things that I think we need to pay very close attention to is how when revolutions seem not to succeed, they have succeeded. In other words, if you look at the revolution of 1968 worldwide, okay, young people from Japan to Paris to, you know, Karachi to Mexico City, rebelling in Columbia University, Madison, Wisconsin, rebelling all over the world. It looks like right after their rebellion ended, they cut their hair off, went to Wall Street, Reaganism and Thatcherism arrived, etc. But guess what? Because of that rebellion, certain communitarian ideas also come to stay. Feminism is going to be cemented through that period. So there's a lot that's won. New social identities will be created, even though it appears sometimes that a revolution has not succeeded. So please, when I say that in Egypt, the general will come and certain concessions are made, and the important 1979 so-called peace agreement between Israel and Egypt will have to stay, that doesn't mean that this has not been an incredible revolution. That new social horizons have not been created, because they have been created. New social horizons have been created so that in this current referendum, there was incredible agitation that more was not being provided. So Egypt, despite the fact that the United States played a very bizarre game, not necessarily bad game, but bizarre, he would not have been my first choice as the American envoy, particularly because the United States has an interesting ambassador in station, and her name is Margaret Scobie. And you will find some interesting feature in the State Department. There are some incredible women ambassadors. Margaret Scobie in Cairo, and Ann Patterson is in Islamabad, Pakistan. But the United States government prefers to send these guys like Wisner to Cairo to deal with Mubarak rather than Margaret Scobie, who has actually a genuine commitment to human rights. They'll prefer to send a repellent man who died and was celebrated like he was a god, Richard Holbrooke, to Islamabad, rather than let Ann Patterson deal with the Pakistanis. She has a genuine commitment to human rights. It's very interesting how there's this pattern. There'll be these women sent as ambassadors, but they are just treated on the side. And when you read the WikiLeaks cables from Islamabad, you will sense Ann Patterson's deep frustration. So that was the story in Egypt. Very bizarre case of sending Wisner. And then these revolts will start to come on the eastern rim of the Arabian Peninsula, particularly in Bahrain. Now, the thing about the eastern rim of the peninsula, I'm trying to build up for you the narrative of the pillars of stability, as it were, and why Libya on this end is going to become the place to intervene militarily. So I'm going to tell you a little story about eastern rim as I understand it, and then come over to Libya. In 1979, the big pillar of stability, that is Iran, is going to suffer, as far as U.S. foreign policy is concerned, a defeat. That is, when the Iranian revolution takes place and the Islamic Republic is created shortly thereafter, it removes the principal pillar of stability from the column of U.S. power. And the United States then is going to put very many more of its hopes in the Israeli basket, and partially in Iraq. Of course, Iraq is going to get financed, the war will begin. But forget all that. Inside these countries, Saudi Arabia in the lead, Bahrain, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, these countries will gather in 1981, and they will create an organization called the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC. And the GCC will be formed in 1981 with the express purpose of defending the monarchies, the emirates, against Iranian intervention. That is its principal raison d'etre. It will also say we want to create a monetary union, we want to create a free trade area. All that stuff is secondary or tertiary. I mean, till today, the movement towards creating a Gulf dinar has gone nowhere. That's not a primary reason for the existence of the GCC. The main reason is they do military exercises together, and they try to coordinate ideological and military strategy vis-a-vis so-called Iranian intervention. Why are they afraid of Iran? They're not afraid of Iran because of Iran. They're afraid of Iran because of a simple demographic problem. And the demographic problem they've tried to solve, it hasn't worked. The demographic problem is this, that along this rim, a large part of the population in some of these emirates, a majority of the so-called native population are Shia and not Sunni, like the monarchies. So the assumption is that the Shia are dangerous. Of course, they are not just dangerous as Shia. Since the 1950s in Saudi Arabia and the eastern part, there have been working class rebellions in the oil regions. You know, this is the bulk of where Aramco used to have its oil fields, Taif and all these cities around here. In the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, oil workers, the skilled oil workers, that is the sort of labor aristocracy, are from the Shia community. So every time there was an oil strike from the 1950s, and these oil workers would strike, often taking great inspiration from Nasserism, the growth of this feeling of Arab nationalism after 1952, when Gamal Abdel Nasser and his coterie will conduct a coup in Egypt in 52. So NASA will fly into Dharan in 1956, and he'll be greeted with oil workers cheering him on. This terrified the Saudi monarchy. And what you begin to see is an attempt to dislocate these working class struggles by calling them not oil worker struggles, but the revival of the Shia. And these are going to be communalized, or they're going to be sectarianized from the 1950s. The government in Saudi Arabia will say this is the Shia fifth column. This is Iranian influence here. When in fact, these people are basically not Iranian, they are not Persian by their self-estimation, they are Arabs, they are Arabic speakers, they happen to be Shia, and they happen to be oil workers, many of them, not all. And one of the ways that, so one of the ways that the GCC tried to undercut the Shia underclass, one of the ways was to suggest that they are a malevolent influence from outside. They're being influenced by Iran. And after 79, this was a huge attempt. You know, they're from outside, they're Iranian influence, the Wafiq party is influenced by people in Iran. You know, these are, should be banned because they are trying to spread the Iranian revolution. The other way that these were attempted to be undercut was a massive importation of foreign workers, particularly from South Asia. So in places like Bahrain, you know, I think 40% of the workforce is from South Asia. And they will come in, and then there will be those residual tensions at the bottom end of the work chain. So these were the two ways in which these countries attempted to defuse a ticking time bomb, which was a time bomb which had all kinds of manifestations. Of course about dignity, of course about the fact that they were an oppressed population. They felt that their religious identity was not recognized. But certainly it had a lot to do with the fact they were oil workers, low level in the economy, and they wanted a greater share of the massive oil profits coming into their societies. So when the Bahrain event takes place, you have to understand Bahrain is like an island with a bridge that leads to Saudi Arabia, what they call a causeway. And it's a beautiful place. Unlike Sarah Palin in Alaska, you know, where you can see Russia, she said, you can see on a clear day Iran from Bahrain, because it actually sits out there in the Persian Gulf, you know, like a little island with a causeway attached to it. Now, Bahrain is running out of oil. It is estimated that this year or next year will be the final years of Bahraini oil. So there's a great deal of tension in this country about its so-called developmental path, which in Adam Smith's terms would be deeply unnatural. I don't know if anybody reads Adam Smith, but Adam Smith believed that the natural economy was agriculture first, then industry, and then trade. And he said the natural one is China. The unnatural one is Holland. Foreign trade first, then industry, then agriculture. He called that the unnatural mode. Well, Bahrain would be the super unnatural mode because it's oil and oil and oil. And I don't know what you'd call Dubai, which is a fantasy mode of development. Hotels and islands and... How many of you have been to Dubai? Only one or two people. It's a fantasy. It doesn't exist on the planet Earth. It's... When I was small, I was flying to England, and we used to, the plane from South Asia would land in Manama. That was before Dubai. Manama and Aden were the two airports. Now, nobody flies to Manama unless you're crazy, really, because unless you want to go and see how beautiful it is, because Dubai has overrun the whole area with its airport. It is one giant mall. That's its mode of development. So when Bahrain opened up, this was seen, I think, very astutely by the royal family in Saudi Arabia as a direct challenge to the Emirate model. And, you know, Yemen could be handled. I think they understood that Yemen could be handled. There were all kinds of institutional supports to handle the uprising in Yemen, and they've handled it very smoothly. There's a so-called prolonged transition. And if you want, we can talk about that later. There's a very prolonged transition, and a lot of blood is going to be shed in Yemen. And the boogie of Al-Qaeda is incredible there. You know, but Bahrain, when the GCC made a decision, they said, we are going to have to put this down. There is no way any reform will be allowed because the door must not open. If the door opens in Bahrain, it will spread everywhere. Okay, now just keep that in mind because there will be a certain agreement that takes place that helps the Arab League make up its mind vis-a-vis Libya, which has Bahrain as part of the story. Okay. 15th of February, a human rights lawyer, 39-year-old human rights lawyer by the name of Fateh Terbil, is arrested in Benghazi. Now, he's an interesting man. He is a young lawyer, 39 years old, who's representing the families of 1,000 people who were killed in 1996 in the Abu Sina prison in Benghazi. Benghazi? Tripoli. They were killed in Tripoli. 1,000 people in 1996. Libya has had a series of rebellions from the 1980s. But, you know, nobody cares because what people, the way the Libya is portrayed, everybody says it's a closed society. It's not that closed, but what people concentrate on in Libya is the foibles of Gaddafi. He's a colorful character. People know when he came to New York, he brought his tent. When he was in Italy recently, he said to the Italian TV broadcaster, they said, "What do you think is the future of Europe?" And he, because he's an insane person, said, "The future of Europe is Islam." I mean, he does things like this at the G8 meeting. He would go and change the seat names around so he could sit next to Obama. Because the media is concentrated on that. People don't observe that Libya has had a series of rebellions. In 1980, a major rebellion in the military. And why is there these rebellions? One of the real reasons, one of the principal reasons, is Libya has an east-west cardinal divide. That is a big piece of it. There is, when from the Ottoman period, the vilayets were divided up, and there's a great sense of remove between the two. In fact, when Gaddafi conducts his coup in 69, he overthrows King Idris, who's the king that comes from the east. Benghazi was the old capital of Libya. And so there is a east-west divide for you to keep in mind somewhat, but it need not be fully completely exaggerated. Then there are, when Gaddafi comes in 69, he favors a few groups. The first tribe that he favors is, of course, his own tribe. Then he favors the other tribe, which is the army officers around him. You know, they are the really favored tribe. And then there are some, and then some tribes are repressed, and conservative religions are repressed initially. Gaddafi doesn't come as a secular leader. He comes as a kind of social justice Islamist. You know, he has a green book. He sets up this Islamic movement to go and overthrow, you know, in Chad and other places, the kind of Islamic socialism that he wants to export from Libya. So he's not a secular leader like Nasser was. He was a more complicated, bizarre ideology that he had. I may be the only one in this room that's read the Green Book. It's not necessary for you to read it. It's not very interesting. It's quite rambling, a little bit like his son. His son, Saif, has inherited a lot from his father. It's kind of rambling, bizarre. And I'll get to Saif in a little bit. So 15th of February of this year, Terbil was arrested in Benghazi. Now, he had planned to hold a Days of Rage, just as was held in Egypt, and just as was held in Bahrain, and just as was planned in Saudi. But a few days before the event could take place in Saudi, in the streets of Riyadh outside his home, the planner of the owner of the Facebook site was shot to death. That was not reported, I don't think. Was it reported? But how much was it reported? Like this. Yeah, fine. I mean, I don't know how many people even knew there was a Days of Rage to have happened in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's inconceivable, right? Saudi, all the women wear hijab, all the men wear jalabiya. Our images come from Michael Moore. That offensive film. That film was okay, but those scenes were offensive. Of this sort of excess of Saudi men walking around. You know, you remember that? What is that movie? Fahrenheit. There were these scenes of Saudi men roaming around, and it was meant to revulse you. I thought that was a little disgusting. you know, I mean, that's the way they dress. What's wrong with that? There was a scene of one Saudi man holding George Bush's hand, a little homophobic, and it was a problematic section in that movie. You know, it was emphasizing, look, he's silly. But at any rate, Days of Rage to be planned February 17th. February 17th is an important date. Why? In 2006, most recently, on February 17th, there was a demonstration in Benghazi around the Danish cartoon controversy that some of you may know. And Gaddafi, which is his mood, cracked down on it, 11 dead on the streets of Benghazi. And so what Terbil had decided, he's the lawyer defending the families of the 1996 massacre in the prison, said, on the 5th anniversary of February 17th, let's have a demonstration. And he's arrested. So, the contagion comes from other parts of the Arab world, And there are small sporadic demonstrations in Libya in February 17th. And something is brewing for sure. In Benghazi, parts of the military go over to the side of this inchoate rebellion. Gaddafi is cracking down. Similar kind of taste of steel as the Saudis demonstrated, you know, but again, that is underneath. One doesn't see that much. And the steel that the Bahrainis put forward, that is also underneath. We talk about Facebook. I'll introduce you to the head of the Human Rights Commission in Bahrain. He has a Facebook site. He puts regularly pictures of people who have disappeared. You know, I don't know. That is a disappeared story itself. Today there was something in the paper, and the Bahrain government immediately said it was a bad story in the New York Times. So, and Gaddafi starts to crack down. Now, he cracks down in a way only he knows. You know, Gaddafi is a little bit that way, like the Syrian father, Hafiz al-Assad, not this one. This one is a sophisticated dictator. His father was a brutal dictator, 10,000 people killed in a city, you know, an uprising, right, 1982. 10,000 dead. That guy, you know, bodies meant nothing to him. Gaddafi is like that, brutal guy. Then on 26th of February, as the rebellion starts to increase, what is that rebellion's character? I'll get to in a minute. The UN Security Council passes a resolution, 1970, which says arms embargo on Libya. This was an important resolution. It said arms embargo on Libya. Gaddafi, you are under watch. Very important resolution. The African Union meets. The African Union is a rather toothless body when it comes to Libya because Gaddafi is the great paymaster. You know, and nobody had the nerve or will to do anything except that they put together a very high-level panel to go to Tripoli and talk to Gaddafi. So that was being set up. The Arab League also said we are going to try to put some pressure on him. So that was 26th of February that you had this happen. 27th of February in Benghazi, a transnational council is created. And they declare that we are the government of Libya, not Gaddafi. And some characters will come there, which I'll also get to in a minute. Gaddafi will start moving his troops out towards the eastern part. There are troops who have defected, remember, and they engage Ras Lanuf, they'll engage Brega, they'll engage Ajtabiya. They go back and forth even in the early days. So far, there was no talk of massacre. Okay, they were fighting back and forth. And this is why I didn't understand how many people on the left here started to suddenly talk about massacre. You know, people like Gilbert, who I respect greatly, also said a massacre was coming. I was not sure what they were talking about because the Gaddafi's tanks were far outside Benghazi and not approaching the city when the talk of massacre now started coming in late February, early March. By then, some equations had changed. And the equation that changed for me was a new cast of characters will come in Benghazi. The first cast of characters, who are the rebels? The rebels were these human rights people, people like Terbil. The rebels were various entrepreneurs and business people who had come up largely because Gaddafi in the last 15 years has promoted privatization and has in sense created these new social identities. A set of them had in fact fashioned themselves as the February 17th movement, which is why on some of the rebel tanks you will see February 17th written in paint on the tanks. So secondly, there are these people coming. Then there were young people generally in the east, but also working class people in the west who were restive. You know, in two or three cities, Misrata, Zintan, inside Tripoli, in some working class areas, there was rumbling, certainly. And a movement was developing. And then the last cast of characters were the people whose commitments were toward political Islam. That has an interesting history. Eastern Libya has a long history of Islamic-based rebellion. It is from that region that you had the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was formed in the late 1980s, I think. It's from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group that people went to Afghanistan and fought alongside the Mujahideen against the Soviets. It's from that part of Libya, that from towns like Drega, that people went to Iraq. In fact, there's a great WikiLeaks cable where a U.S. State Department official from Tripoli bunks his minder and drives along the Mediterranean road, gets to a city in the east, talks to some people, and the sheikh tells him that, yes, people from here are going to fight in Iraq, but we are not going to fight in Iraq because we want to fight against Iraq. We are going. These young boys are going because they cannot fight in Libya. That was a great cable. You know, so Iraq was standing in for Gaddafi, in a way. So you have these elements, but you have to remember that in the 1990s, Gaddafi smashed the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And then after the 1990s, many of their leaders came out with a sort of anti-extremist form of Islamism. So they are not, it's the bogey of Al-Qaeda. You know, Al-Qaeda, this bogey in Mali, Al-Qaeda, the Maghreb, I mean, those are Tuaregs, those are trans-Saharan smugglers. You know, Al-Qaeda for a lot of places is like a franchise. If I sold hamburgers on like 53rd Street in New York City, you wouldn't buy them from me. You know, you'd think, what are these, some halal burgers or whatever. I'm not gonna. But if I called it McDonald's, you'd come. So these trans-Saharan smugglers, they said, Al-Qaeda of the Maghreb. And they said, now our shop is open for business. I mean, there's a Dutch reporter that I spoke to who has spent a lot of time in northern Mali. He said these guys wouldn't know Al-Qaeda, you know, from Salafi, like a text. These guys don't know any of that stuff. This is just a thing. Now, there are, of course, some hardened fellows in there. You know, no doubt about that. But it's not the general trend. Similarly, in Libya, by all accounts, these are not your Al-Qaeda, you know, the small core, the hardened people who are willing to sacrifice like that. They are definitely inspired by Islam in one variety or the other. But this is not like the tentacles of Bin Laden. So that's simply a silly thing. So those were the rebels. This is a kind of ragtag bunch of people. They had come to this. Many were not prepared to sacrifice. That was the other thing. John Lee Anderson is there right now, and he writes to say that he visited some rebels who told him, you know, we went to the front and they were shooting at us, so we came back. We didn't want a part of this. And, you know, I sympathize with them. I don't want to be somewhere with people shooting at me, you know. I mean, I'm a coward. I don't want that. I would like to stand in a square and, you know, have the camel riding brutal fellows come in and the Muslim Brotherhood let them go and face them and die, which is what they did in Tahrir Square. It's the Muslim Brotherhood that went and faced because they're disciplined, trained, and you know what? They believe in the future. Whereas I'm not fully convinced. I'm very much a liver in the present. You have to have an eschatology. You have to believe in like the revolution or in, you know, the heaven or something. If you don't believe in the revolution, you will not sacrifice. If your teachers tell you, by the way, don't be teleological, what they're telling you is don't dream and have faith in the future. You know, you have to be teleological if you're political. You have to believe that it's going somewhere. Fine, in a paper you should be nuanced and all that, but teleology is essential for politics. And those Muslim brothers, they are teleological, believe me. They believe they're going to win. They are really. And so are some people, not all of them. Many came back and said, thanks. You know, it's not fair. Gaddafi is not playing fair. What did you expect him to do? He is a brutal leader of a country who has crushed every single rebellion beforehand. You cannot take up arms unless you're prepared to fight him. You cannot go and face him and then turn around and say he's not playing fair. The same thing happened in Bahrain, and people were crushed, sent home, and they are regrouping and ready and hardened and ready to fight again. So we have to have a long view when we understand these movements. Now, the United States played, a very tricky game here. Some characters will enter the story. So I've told you a little about the rebels who come February 15th and 17th and up to the Transitional Council. Now, one mysterious guy shows up in Benghazi. Now, I got a tip from somebody about 2 weeks ago, look at Hifter. So I said, what do you mean, look at Hifter? Then he said, I'll give you two words, you do the rest. Hifter, Vienna. So I said, what is Hifter, Vienna? I have a friend who knows Washington, D.C. in and out. So Vienna, that's the town in Virginia. Call the town hall, any Hifter? Yes, Khalifa Hifter. He's got a house, something, Country Road. He just sold it for $612,000. He had bought it 8 years ago for $640,000 or $60,000. He made a $40,000 loss. I talked to some people, clarified he lived there. Fine, I found out simply from driving directions on MapQuest, 7 miles from Langley. So Khalifa Hifter lived in Vienna, Virginia for about 20 years. So who is this guy? In the 1980s, he was a colonel in the Libyan army fighting the war in Chad. And at some point in the army, in the war, not clear when, he went over to the rebel side and joined the Libyan National Salvation Front. And then the regime in Chad will change. I think, what is his name? Helene Habre regime. And then Hitler disappears from Chad. Now, how many people here have been to a U.S. embassy trying to get papers to enter America? Anybody been? Yes? How easy is it? You go there, they're welcoming! Come on! Hug you! Shake your hand! Champagne! You win the lottery! How did this guy, who was a colonel in the Libyan army, fighting an insurgency in Chad, show up weeks later in a house in Vienna, Virginia? 7 miles away from Langley, he lives there. And from the United States, he will start an organization called the Libyan National Army. Post office box in Virginia. And then they will attempt a coup in 96, crushed. Late February, early March, he shows up in Benghazi, and he is now the leader of the troops. So on the ground, you have Hiftar I, colonel, and the former interior minister, who is the titular general. They have taken over the fighting on the ground. That is now late February, after the UN resolution 1970, early March. Definitely by 11th March, he was in charge of the troops, whatever the troops may be.
Rebels,
correct. He is on the side of the rebellion. So that's the military leadership. I'm going to come back to the military question. Then there's a civilian leadership. Now, again, a provisional council is created. All kinds of popular democratic things are happening. It's all going fine in Libya. I mean, Gaddafi is going to strike. But there's all these popular initiatives starting. All that will end. A new man will take charge of details at the political end, and his name is Mahmoud Jibril. Now, Jibril is an interesting character. He was Saif al-Islam's right-hand guy, and he ran the so-called, what you might consider, the privatization ministry in Gaddafi's regime. Now, Gaddafi, from 69 to maybe the late 70s, he ignored the political question. That is, Gaddafi is one of the few leaders in the world who centralized power and called it decentralization. I mean, it's like an extraordinary thing. You know, he called these popular democracies. He still says, I am not a leader. I'm just an ordinary man. I'm not even the leader of Libya. And next breath he'll say, you'll never remove me from power. So, first 10 years, incredible moves that he makes. You know, he radicalizes OPEC on the global stage. He will bring in, he'll nationalize, he'll throw out Bunker Hunt and the Hunt brothers and all these Occidental Petroleum, and he tosses them all out. Very radical first 10 years. He improves the livelihood of the people, no question. In fact, Libya on economic grounds has the highest human development index in Africa. First 15 years or so, he's doing fine. Then, when the oil money starts coming in, I mean, this guy is like he's damned by that. Why? He starts to privatize the country. That's one. He will beg the US and Europe and others to bring him back into the fold. There's a hiccup in 86 when there's a Gulf of Sidra incident and a bombing in his compound, and his adopted daughter died. Now people say may not have died. I don't know. Let's just assume she died. Hannah. Some people say she's still alive. I don't know. He has 7 children. And 2 adopted children. But anyway, it is said at that time that she was killed in the bombing. Some hiccups, but Gaddafi from the 80s is reaching out to the West. And there are two men who become central to the outreach. One of them is Mohammed Jibril, who will conduct this privatization. And if you go to WikiLeaks, which, by the way, is my nighttime reading every day, as you can see, in WikiLeaks, he is meeting the ambassador all the time. And telling the ambassador things like, you people made a mistake after 1989. That's my favorite cable. He says, you made a mistake. You should not have put boots on the ground in the Arab world. You should have used soft power. Then you would be on top. Like, for instance, McDonald's. Sell everybody McDonald's. You'll mesmerize them into loving America. So Jibril enters as essentially the political officer of the rebellion. And he is in the Elysee Palace in Paris. He is in London. He is everywhere. And he's the kind of classic neoliberal guy, educated University of Pittsburgh in strategic engineering, was to privatize and make